At the heart of repentance is indeed a change of direction.
Pastor Peter Bender speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
But the change of direction begins at the fundamental level of the human person, the heart itself, which the scriptures describe as the seat of faith. We are conceived and born in sin since Adam's fall, and therefore we are bent against God. We have no natural love for God. We have no natural trust for God. And the one we trust in is ourselves.
You can listen to Pastor Bender's presentation, Making the Case for Lutheran Piety, and all of the speakers at our 2017 conferences on an audio DVD. It contains almost 20 hours of teaching and preaching. We'll send it to you for a $300 year-end tax-deductible donation. Look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. I don't know if you see this in your Twitter feed, but I do on a regular basis, maybe because I follow these kinds of things from the science community, from NASA, from space.com. All the time, there is something being said about life on other worlds or what we might hope to find in terms of life on other worlds, of exploring not only our solar system, but perhaps beyond it. Then you come across a column in the Wall Street Journal titled Finding God on a Mars Colony. Of all things, Pastor James Heiser is quoted in there. We're going to be talking about that column for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon. Pastor James Heiser is our guest. He's Bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Diocese of North America, a member of the Board of Directors and the Steering Committee for the Mars Society, and author of several books, including The Myth of Mars, Imagining the Course of Human Destiny. Bishop Heiser, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you again.
You are quoted in this Wall Street Journal column talking about the result of the Copernican revolution, or at least one of the distance results, being, as you say, they quote you from a 2013 address to the Mars Society's annual convention. Many people have become comfortable speaking of humanity as a virus the Earth might be better off without. What kind of concern were you expressing there?
Well, I was reacting to the mentality that you find within certain extreme elements of the environmentalist movement, who tend to view the ideal population of the Earth as zero when we're speaking of human beings, obviously drawing on the example of the most radical elements within that community, but nonetheless is a sentiment which we find in many broad portions of the left. I mean, it's the motivating principle for Planned Parenthood, for example, that's, you know, the ideal number of people is fewer than we have right now. It's the mentality whenever we have those in positions of authority who view economics as a zero-sum game and who then view human beings as those who divide an ever-shrinking pie of prosperity. And so therefore, the fewer people who are being cared for out of available resources, the better. Whereas actually much of the experience of the West has been through technology and through sound economic principles to continue to make more and more resources available to make the life of more people better. And so I was reacting to that environmentalist pseudo-religion, which seems to denigrate the existence of the human race.
I want to ask you about the way that the column characterized the Copernican Revolution, and it's often characterized this way, as though man was kind of riding high with this notion that at least astronomically he and his planet sat at the center of the universe, or maybe the solar system, if not the universe. And Copernicus came along and dethroned man from that privileged position. I think that's even the term that the Wall Street Journal column uses. Is that an accurate way of describing what happened when Copernicus looked at the evidence and said, well, I think maybe the sun is at the center of the solar system?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when Copernicus came along, there was not yet the scientific evidence to really make the case for a heliocentric solar system. It was a theory that he was setting forth. But there's a world of difference between Copernicus engaged in science and the so-called Copernican principle. And one of the things that should be setting off our alarm bells the moment we hear that notion of the Copernican principle having dethroned man from his central place is that it's fundamentally misstates the Ptolemaic view of man and the earth as being not the center of the universe, but essentially at the bottom. In other words, the Ptolemaic system, drawing on Aristotle, viewed the world of matter as essentially the bottom. And so, therefore, far from this being a place of privilege, was a place of relative unimportance in comparison to what was going on in the heavens. It was suffice to say, those who advocate for the Copernican principle don't really understand what was being maintained by the earlier system of astronomy. But, of course, I don't think they're going to let facts get in their way on that. The principle of uniformity is really what the Copernicans were trying to get at, which is the idea that everywhere the laws of the universe are the same. And certainly, as those who believe in the triune God, who is the creator of heaven and earth, we recognize that the creator of all things, most likely in all of the physical realm, built the rules to be the same. So that shouldn't surprise us.
It's also posited, or at least strongly implied, that the Copernican ideas were a great blow to Christian theology. Is that true?
If they're supposed to be, there was no contemporary evidence to that effect. And in fact, most of the early astronomers, and some of the most revered to this day, people like Johannes Kepler, were quite outspoken in their Christian viewpoint, and saw their faith as a motivation for the reason why they engaged in science.
Let's talk about the partnership that has existed between human exploration and religion, in particular, in the West, Christianity. Very few attempts to explore our planet have come without some sort of religious element. How are those two joined together in the history of human exploration of our planet?
Well, I think an important aspect of that was certainly in terms of those who were overtly religiously motivated, was out of a desire to bring the gospel to those who had not yet heard it. And then also, you often had a Christian missionary motivation in terms of those who followed after waves of settlements to guarantee that the gospel would be brought to or retained among those who had been engaged in exploration. But again, having that knowledge that this entire world is the good creation of the Lord kept it from being a place of dread and fear, as if there was some clause forbidding us from traveling around the world. Rather, we see all things as being good and created by the Lord who has fashioned us.
In your opinion, does that apply to the exploration of space, be it either manned exploration or, as we most often and most economically find it feasible to do, exploring remotely our solar system?
Well, it's all part of God's creation. And it's, you know, whenever we speak of heaven and the heavens, obviously the domain of the Lord is beyond the realm of that which is observable in the night sky. There's certainly nothing forbidding us from exploring it. And as it teaches us more about the creation which God has fashioned, I think it's a good thing in and of itself to continue to explore. While at the moment it may seem most feasible to engage in robotic exploration, certainly with some of the recent advances, not least of which by SpaceX and Elon Musk's efforts, the possibility of human exploration continues to expand and become more economical as time passes.
Now, there's exploration, and then there's what usually at least the press jumps to, and that is colonization. In fact, sure, they talk about colonizing Mars, but what's the difference between those two?
Well, see, there's a number of factors that complicate going from kind of step one, which is exploration, to step two, colonization. And a big part of exploration is to determine in part to learn about the physical properties of the place which you are exploring, but also, as human beings always do, to explore whether or not this is a viable place for human habitation. We've done this with our own world in that, if you take a person without technology and take them from the tropics and drop them in the middle of Colorado, they probably won't fare particularly well, save for what men have done to develop means for coping with various terrestrial environments. But even we've found that not all places are particularly well suited for economically viable human habitation on this planet. So when we look at Mars, there's first the aspect of exploration and seeing what there is to learn there, and then determining whether or not it's actually a place that would be viable for long-term human habitation or colonization. And those are questions you really can't answer authoritatively in advance. You've got to actually see what the environment is there. And that's not something which is done entirely robotically. That's something that involves actually sending human beings and seeing what the environment is or could be through technological means.
Bishop James Heiser is our guest. We're talking about a column in the Wall Street Journal titled Finding God on a Mars Colony, wherein he is quoted talking about exploration. When we come back, two objections. It's expensive and it's dangerous. Stay tuned.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
How do we continue faithfully to confess and practice our Lutheran faith in a culture of secularism, pluralism, and relativism? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is the 2017 edition of Luther's Small Catechism with Explanation. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Luther's Small Catechism with Explanation, 2017 edition.
Comfort, comfort, ye my people, for unto us a child is born, good news of great joy, the titles of Christ, the Magnificat. These are some of the Christmas card themes produced by Ad Crucem. Send a greeting card this Christmas season that's centered on the gospel of Jesus Christ. AdCrucem.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com. ADCRUCEM.com.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a column in the Wall Street Journal titled Finding God on a Mars Colony. Pastor James Heiser of the Mars Society is our guest. Bishop Heiser, there are usually two related objections that are raised to human exploration of space, and it's regardless of whether we're talking about going to space just to orbit or going to space to explore the moon again or to explore Mars or even to colonize. The two objections are related to one another. One has to do with the dollars and cents. It is outrageously expensive to send anything into space, much less to send human beings into space. And the other objection is that it's expensive in terms of not just money, but of lives. It's also very, very dangerous to do so. Respond to both of those, if you would.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The first part of that with the expense, I'm always intrigued because the people who suddenly become very, very concerned with matters of fiscal responsibility and space exploration usually try to then dodge the whole issue of the improvements in human conditions that have been brought about by the technological advances that have accompanied the entire space program. These are things which would never have been done if not for those purposes. And it's everything from composites to advances in electronics. I'd love to see somebody blogging from their iPhone about the evils of the space program, since everything that they're doing depends on the infrastructure that was a result of that space program. But again, a lot of these efforts that are being explored right now are being undertaken by private entities. And probably one of the leading examples of that is the SpaceX Corporation, which posits the idea of space exploration as at least in large part a privately funded endeavor. So telling other people what to do with their own money is kind of a curious prospect. I'm sorry, what was your second question?
The second objection is often the risk. Is it worth the...
Right.
Space is dangerous. There's no two ways about it. But the risk, is it worth human lives to explore?
Well, and again, I mean, we're extremely fortunate that people before us did not answer in the negative in that regard, since for all of us who are now enjoying comfortable lives in North America, where we drive our automobiles from place to place or get an airplane if we want to get there even more quickly, have ancestors who have engaged in all kinds of almost unimaginable by modern standards levels of risk, and we also engage day by day in activities which are inherently dangerous. The probabilities of you dying in a car wreck are not trivial, or at least suffering major injury, and yet every day, tens of millions of Americans say, you know what, it's worth the risk, and engage in that endeavor. Everything involves risk, and there are many things which are worth doing, not only for ourselves, but for our communities, which are worthy of greater risk than others.
So you have mentioned the privately funded attempts. There's even a stated goal. I don't know if it's a goal as much as it is a hope to have something approaching a colony on Mars under Musk's financing by 2024, mm-hmm. which every year seems not enough time to do it. Is that a realistic goal?
Now you're asking me a technical question that falls outside my area of expertise. What I can say to that is a lot of people in the industry in aerospace were saying that what Musk was going to do in terms of inexpensive launches was impossible, that what he was going to do in terms of reusable first stages to those rockets was impossible. But he keeps doing things that aren't supposed to be possible. So I don't want to exclude anything from being within the realm of the possible. Whether or not the goal in the early to mid-2020s is feasible, or whether it ends up being in the 2030s, or not at all, I think that given his track record of success thus far, I mean, he's certainly helping to lay the foundation for opening up a viability for space exploration, which is much better than what we had seen previously. I think it's been underappreciated what their development in terms of reusable launch vehicles and less expensive launches has meant in terms of just bringing down the cost of space transport already. And that is already opening space to less expensive satellite systems, etc. And that's already making a difference in terms of perceived quality of life here on Earth. So I'd say betting against Musk at this point is probably not a good bet to take.
You spoke earlier about the relationship between religious ideas and the exploration of our planet. Is there a mm-hmm. similar relationship between kind of the Christian impetus to explore, in some cases explicitly for the sake of the mission, and the exploration of space?
I think there can be. Certainly when you look at some of the early American endeavors when colonies were being established, some of them explicitly religious in their genesis, others developing a religious component as time went on. From the time of the pilgrims, you had a community which was about half religious and about half non. That tends to be the part that gets forgotten in that story, is that about half of the people who went were actually there for various technical purposes, for various trades, which the religious settlers didn't bring to the equation. But I think what we'll find is that wherever you have human beings, you will have the church endeavoring to bring the gospel to them. And sometimes that can seem in a very exotic kind of environment. The idea of colonies in other worlds is the same kind of level of order of strange as the idea of crossing the ocean to inhabit a empty wasteland of a continent inhabited by people who are hostile to your being there. Nonetheless, we've engaged in those activities before. One of the things that tends to get forgotten, even in terms of our own Lutheran heritage, several points. first, if we remember the German Bavarian theologian Wilhelm Leib, when he established colonies in Michigan, which he, of course, himself never actually visited, but to which hundreds of settlers were sent. They were sent for the explicit purpose of bringing the gospel to American Indians. And again, when you look to the early colonial days, you actually had the Swedish government established an entire Lutheran colony in what we now know as Delaware, New Sweden, as it was called at the time, before the Calvinists decided to invade it and take it over. But that's a story for another day. So you tend to have, either in the leadership or in the waves of immigration which follow, wherever men go, the gospel will be sent or will accompany as men proceed in the first moves. And I see this as something which is inherent in the Christian desire to continue to promulgate the gospel.
Popularly perceived, much of the exploration of space nowadays, I do not think that this was the case decades ago, but I think it is now, seems to be driven by a desire to find either evidence for life or life-sustaining conditions, even places that we will reasonably never visit, like the exoplanets. Mm-hmm. Mars in particular, searching for the evidence of past life, perhaps, or some other kind of life that seems to have survived in what would be ordinarily extraordinarily hostile environment. That's it. Is my perception of that the goal here seems to have shifted on the part of science, at least as it's popularly presented to us?
I think that often aspects of space science are presented in that way because they perceive that to be something which interests the public and which can at least hold their attention for a while, because a lot of what's going on scientifically may be very interesting, but it doesn't fit into a easy headline. And that I think that the media often sells short the interest and attention span of the general public, so that when you see the major media chasing after science headlines, it's usually something which they think is extraordinary or flashy. And so if you talk about life on Mars, that's going to get a lot of attention. If you want to talk about a fragmentary magnetic field in certain parts of the Martian surface, that doesn't draw the same kind of immediate attention because it requires explanation. So I think that that's part of the problem, is not necessarily what's going on with the science so much as what's going on with the way that interest is taken in science within the broader environment of the media. Now, that being said, there are difficulties within the public space program of NASA, where there are competing ideologies, one side of which is obsessed with looking down, in short, trying to turn our NASA into essentially the global warming department and all concerned with such pseudoscientific terrestrial concerns, while the other part of NASA is more true to the original mission, which is to continue to explore the heavens. I think that in the broader terms of ideology, you find a great difference in the worldview between those two camps. But there's no denying the fact that there's a great deal of popular interest in those questions, which are very easily understood. And the idea of the search for life elsewhere certainly intrigues a large portion of the population.
When we come back, we're going to get Pastor James Heiser's thoughts on, well, now almost 60 years of space exploration. We're talking about a column for the Wall Street Journal titled Finding God on a Mars Colony. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Friday afternoon, we're talking about a column in the Wall Street Journal titled Finding God on a Mars Colony. Pastor James Heiser is our guest, Bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Diocese of North America, member of the Board of Directors and the Steering Committee for the Mars Society, and author of several books, including The Myth of Mars, Imagining the Course of Human Destiny. Bishop Heiser, as we speak, there are two spacecraft that, there's some debate about this, but at least for the last 4 or 5 years, one of them has been considered outside the solar system. Leaving the solar system, these two spacecraft launched to explore the planets of our solar system and then sent on their way are now outside the boundary, so to speak. What are your thoughts on, well, now 60 years of space exploration, including these that are leaving our planetary system?
You know, it's intriguing because as soon as you phrase it that way, it's left the planetary portion of the solar system that we know about. And the stunning thing, when we look at the vastness of the creation, is the realization that in terms of the hypothetical portions of our solar system, the full extent of the range of the comets, the possibility of an Oort cloud that's at present not even visible to Earth observation, which they think is the location from which cometary bodies are drawn and then come down to the earlier into the inner system. Throughout the rest of our lifetimes, those spacecraft will still not have reached the expanse of those portions of the solar system. And so the vastness of that which God has fashioned, so that even to this day, human instruments can't measure the full extent of just this one solar system, is breathtaking. And to think of these small, frail vessels that we've hurled out into the void, how mighty are the works of God, that everything which man, in all of his planning, all of his engineering, all of the extent of his science, can just barely begin to probe and measure a small portion of that vast expanse is breathtaking. It should be quite humbling for us to realize that after all of this effort, still all we can do is behold and marvel that which God gave form to in a few days.
Another breakthrough that has that I mentioned briefly before that has come in the last decade or so is the ability to detect and perhaps even begin in a very rudimentary way to analyze planets that circle stars quite distant from us to say, ah, we know that there's a planet there. What can we say about it? What do you make of that? And it's largely through various kinds of space-based telescopes. What do you make of that way of exploring God's creation?
I think it's marvelous. I think we're learning a great deal. Again, I think it's something where a general public awareness of what's actually being discovered would be very helpful because, you know, they'll talk about, you know, finding Earth-like planets and so forth. What I think is often not adequately explained is that when they talk about something being Earth-like, that means it's according a world that's according to the best that we can determine within the range of distance from a star where you could have liquid water present. It doesn't mean that there are other habitable worlds out there. It means that there are other worlds where Earth-like conditions aren't inherently ruled out. And yet, in all of this study of the heavens in which we have engaged so far, what we continue to see is that Earth thus far stands unique in all of the cosmos, that in all of this ordered creation, there's nothing else that has been precisely like it. We aren't at the point yet where we can study atmospheric makeup of these distant worlds, and really much of what we can tell about them is quite rudimentary, general notions about the size, about their distance from their respective stars, and then making speculations based on what we know about the brightness of those stars with which they circle. But when you consider the fact that, again, this is all part of that creation which God gave form to in such a brief period of time, it's a breathtaking thing to behold.
Finally, I have to ask you, even though the book came out, he just came out with a second book, Artemis. Andy Weir wrote a book some years ago called Martian, and it was made into a rather compelling film about an attempt to colonize the red planet. Mm-hmm. But the story ended up being about trying to bring one man back safely to Earth. What is so fascinating to us as human beings that we want to explore, but we also deeply desire to get home?
Well, and I think in the case of Andy Weir's story, that was a bit of an involuntary colonization effort, to be fair to the character. He wanted to get home because he wasn't actually supposed to stay. But I think that there is something very deep within our psyche that looks time and again to stories of the adventure, of the journey, but then also of the return to all of that which we hold dear. But colonization is, in that sense, a very different impetus from exploration. And that really, Andy Weir's story was one that was presents a character who thought he was going merely on a journey of exploration and just about ended up having to be a permanent colonist. But that, you know, if you can go all the way back to the time of the ancient Greeks, and the stories are of travel and of return. And it appears to be something which appeals to something very deep in our hearts and minds ever since the time of Homer to the present. We yearn to see that which we have not yet known, but also to know the stability of everything which has come before us, which we're building on. Colonization, whether on Earth or, if the Lord so wills, on other worlds, is precisely about taking that which we have valued and bringing it with us to a new abode. It's why colonies tend to be very conservative places in terms of religious values, historical traditions, and so forth. I mean, that's one of the reasons why in North America you had certain traditions which were clung to more firmly here than they had been in the old countries, because it was something which was a link to an entire heritage that came before us. In the comfort of the old world, they didn't even necessarily think about those things as being particularly precious. But now, in all of the challenges that were opened up in front of settlers, you started to actually value things for what they meant to you.
With about 30 seconds, Bishop Heiser, should Christians fear or be skeptical of what we might find and discover as we explore space and perhaps even other planets?
Absolutely not, because in terms of what we are learning, everything that we learn, which is true, is something which is made by God. And while men may try to speculate and extrapolate beyond the actual data, that's where our calling as Christians is, to always pull people back to the actual facts. What have we learned? Not what we're speculating about from them. But Christians have nothing to fear from science in the proper sense, because it's simply a domain of knowledge and of study of those things which God has made. In the field of science, Christians should continue to lead the way, for we have nothing to fear in that which God has made.
Pastor James Heiser is Bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Diocese of North America, member of the Board of Directors and the Steering Committee for the Mars Society, and author of several books, including The Myth of Mars, Imagining the Course of Human Destiny. You can purchase this book under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Bishop Heiser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back from the break, it's This Week in Pop American Christianity with Pastor Chris Rosebrough. I'm looking at the December issue of the Lutheran Witness magazine. It contains Christmas-related columns by regular guests Pastor Will Whedon, Dr. Curtis Giese, and Pastor Stephen Starkey. They'll send you 6 digital or print issues for only $6.99. Learn more at cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness. Interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective, the Lutheran Witness magazine, cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
At the heart of repentance is indeed a change of direction.
Pastor Peter Bender speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
But the change of direction begins at the fundamental level of the human person, the heart itself, which the scriptures describe as the seat of faith. We are conceived and born in sin since Adam's fall, and therefore we are bent against God. We have no natural love for God. We have no natural trust for God. And the one we trust in is ourselves.
You can listen to Pastor Bender's presentation, Making the Case for Lutheran Piety, and all of the speakers at our 2017 conferences on an audio DVD. It contains almost 20 hours of teaching and preaching. We'll send it to you for a $300 year-end tax-deductible donation. Look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org.